This is Audible.
Recorded Books presents an unabridged recording of HMS Surprise by Patrick O'Brien, narrated by Patrick Tull. This work, copyrighted 1973 by Patrick O'Brien, is recorded by arrangement with Georges Borchardt, Incorporated. This recording is copyrighted 1992 by Recorded Books. In the final scene of Post-Captain, four British frigates, including Jack Aubrey's Lively, encountered the Spanish treasure fleet they'd been sent to detain, a treasure fleet bearing 5 million pieces of eight destined to fund Spain's entrance into the war as Napoleon's ally. In a stunning victory for the small British force, the prizes were taken, and as Captain Aubrey sat down to dinner in his cabin aboard the Lively, along with Dr. Maturin and the captured Spanish admiral, he must have thought that his long financial woes were finally at an end. But it seems the new First Lord of the Admiralty has other plans for the gold. And now, HMS Surprise.
Chapter 1. But I put it to you, my lord, that prize money is of essential importance to the Navy. The possibility, however remote, of making a fortune by some brilliant stroke is an unparalleled spur to the diligence, the activity, and the unremitting attention of every man afloat. I'm sure that the serving members of the board will support me in this, he said, glancing round the table. Several of the uniformed figures looked up, and there was a murmur of agreement. It was not universal, however. Some of the civilians had a stuffed and non-committal air, and one or two of the sailors remained staring at the sheets of blotting paper laid out before them. It was difficult to catch the sense of the meeting, if indeed any distinct current had yet established itself. This was not the usual restricted session of the Lords Commissioners of the Admiralty, but the first omnium gatherum of the new administration, the first since Lord Melville's departure, with several new members, many heads of department and representatives of other boards. They were feeling their way, behaving with politic restraint, holding their fire. It was difficult to sense the atmosphere, but although he knew he didn't have the meeting entirely with him, yet he felt no decided opposition, a wavering, rather. And he hoped that by the force of his own conviction he might still carry his point against the tepid unwillingness of the First Lord. One or two striking examples of this kind, in the course of a long protracted war, are enough to stimulate the zeal of the whole fleet throughout years and years of hardship at sea, whereas a denial, on the other hand, must necessarily have the contrary effect. Sir Joseph was a capable, experienced chief of naval intelligence, but he was no orator, particularly before such a large audience. He had not struck upon the golden phrase. The right words had escaped him, and he was conscious of a certain negative, unpersuaded quality in the air. I cannot feel that Sir Joseph is quite right in attributing such interested motives to the officers of our service, remarked Admiral Hart, bending his head obsequiously towards the First Lord. The other service members glanced quickly at him and at one another. Hart was the most eager pursuer of the main chance in the Navy, the most ardent snapper-up of anything that was going, from a Dutch herring-bus to a Breton fishing-boat. "I am bound by precedent," said the First Lord, turning a vast, glabrous, expressionless face from Hart to Sir Joseph. "There was the case of the Santa Brigida." "The Thetis, my lord," whispered his private secretary. "The Thetis, I mean. and my legal advisers tell me that this is the appropriate decision. We are bound by Admiralty law. If the prize was made before the declaration of war, the proceeds escheat to the Crown. They are droits of the Crown. The strict letter of the law is one thing, my lord, and equity is another. The law is something of which sailors know nothing, but there is no body of men more tenacious of custom, nor more alive to equity and natural justice. The position, as I see it, and as they will see it, is this. Their lordships, fully aware of the Spaniards' intention of entering the war, of joining Bonaparte, took time by the forelock. To carry on a war with any effect, Spain needed the treasure shipped from the River Plate. Their lordships therefore ordered it to be intercepted. It was essential to act without the loss of a moment, and the disposition of the Channel fleet was such that, in short, all we were able to send was a squadron consisting of the frigates Indefatigable, Medusa, Amphion, and Lively. And they had orders to detain the superior Spanish force and to carry it into Plymouth. By remarkable exertions, and, I may say, by the help of a remarkable stroke of intelligence, for which I claim no credit, the squadron reached Cape Santa Maria in time, engaged the Spaniards, sank one and took the others after a determined action, not without grievous loss on our side. They carried out their orders, they deprived the enemy of the sinews of war, and they brought home 5 million pieces of eight. If now they are to be told that these dollars, these pieces of eight, are, contrary to the custom of the service, to be regarded not as prize money at all, but as droits of the crown, why then, it will have a most deplorable effect throughout the fleet. But since the action took place before the declaration of war, began a civilian, "What about Belle Poole in 78? Cried Admiral Parr. "The officers and men of our squadron had nothing to do with any declaration," said Sir Joseph. "They were not to meddle with affairs of state, but to execute the orders of the board. They were fired upon first. Then they carried out their duty according to their instructions, at no small cost to themselves, and with very great advantage to the country. And if they are to be deprived of their customary reward, if, I say, the board, under whose orders they acted, is to appropriate this money, then the particular effect upon the officers concerned, who have been led to believe themselves beyond the reach of want, or of anything resembling want, and who have no doubt committed themselves upon this understanding, will be..." He hesitated for the word.
"Lamentable," said a rear admiral of the blue.
"Lamentable. And the general effect upon the service, which will no longer have this splendid example of what zeal and determination can accomplish, will be far wider, far more to be deplored. This is a discretionary matter, my lord. The precedents point in contrary directions, and none has been tried in a court of law, and I put it to you with great earnestness that it would be far better for the board to use its discretion in the favour of the officers and men concerned. It can be done at no great expense to the country, and the example will repay that expense a hundredfold."
5 million pieces of eight, said Admiral Erskine longingly, in the midst of a general hesitation. Was it indeed as much as that? "Who are the officers primarily concerned?" asked the First Lord.
"Captains Sutton, Graham, Collins, and Aubrey, my lord," said the private secretary. "Here are their files."
There was a silence while the First Lord ran through the papers. A silence broken only by the squeak of Admiral Erskine's pen, converting 5 million pieces of eight to pounds sterling, dividing the result into its customary prize shares, and coming out with the answer that made him whistle.
At the sight of these files, Sir Joseph knew the game was up. The new First Lord might know nothing of the Navy, but he was an old parliamentary hand, an astute politician, and there were two names there that were anathema to the present administration. Sutton and Aubrey would throw the damnable weight of party politics into the wavering balance. And the other two captains had no influence of any kind, parliamentary, social, or service, to redress it. "Sutton, I know in the house," said the First Lord, pursing his mouth and scribbling a note. "And Captain Aubrey. The name is familiar."
"The son of General Aubrey, my lord," whispered the secretary.
"Yes, yes, the member for Great Clangor, who made such a furious attack upon Mr. Addington. He quoted his son in his speech on corruption, I remember. He often quotes his son, yes, yes."
He closed the personal files and glanced at the general report.
"Pray, Sir Joseph," he said after a moment, "who is this Dr. Maturin?"
"He is the gentleman about whom I sent your lordship a minute last week," said Sir Joseph. "A minute in a yellow cover," added with a very slight emphasis. An emphasis that would have been the equivalent of flinging his inkwell at the First Lord's head in Melville's time.
"Is it usual for medical men to be given temporary post-captain's commissions?"
went on the First Lord, missing the emphasis, and forgetting the significance of the yellow cover. All the service members looked up quickly, their eyes running from one to the other. "It was done for Sir Joseph Banks and for Mr. Halley, my lord, and I believe for some other scientific gentleman. It is an exceptional compliment, but by no means unknown."
"Oh,"
said the First Lord, conscious from something in Sir Joseph's cold and weary gaze that he had made a gaffe.
"So it has nothing to do with this particular case?"
"Nothing whatsoever, my lord. And if I may revert for a moment to Captain Aubrey, I may state without fear of contradiction that the father's views do not represent the son's. Far from it, indeed." This he said not from any hope that he could right the position, but by way of drowning the gaffe, of diverting attention from it. And he was not displeased when Admiral Hart, still hoping to curry favour, and at the same time to gratify a personal malevolence, said, "Would it be in order to call upon Sir Joseph to declare a personal interest?"
"No, sir, it would not," cried Admiral Parr, his port wine face flushing purple. "A most improper suggestion, my God."
His voice trailed away in a series of coughs and grunts, through which could be heard,
"Infernal presumption, new member, mere rear admiral, little shit."
"If Admiral Hart means to imply that I am in any way concerned with Captain Aubrey's personal welfare," said Sir Joseph with an icy look, "he is mistaken. I have never met the gentleman. The good of the service is my only aim." Hart was shocked by the reception of what he thought rather a clever remark, and he instantly pulled in his horns. Horns that had been planted among a grove of others by the Captain Aubrey in question. He confounded himself in apologies. He had not meant, he had not wished to imply, what he had really intended. Not the least aspersion on the most honourable gentleman. The First Lord, somewhat disgusted, clapped his hand on the table and said, "But in any event, I cannot agree that $5 million is a trifling expense to the country. And as I have already said, our legal advisers assure me that this must be considered as droits of the crown. Much as I personally should like to fall in with Sir Joseph's, in many ways excellent and convincing, suggestion, I fear we are bound by precedent. It is a matter of principle.
I say it with infinite regret, Sir Joseph, being aware that this expedition, this brilliantly successful expedition, was under your aegis. And no one could wish more wealth and prosperity to the gentlemen of the Navy than myself, but our hands are tied, alas. However, let us console ourselves with the thought that there will be a considerable sum left over to be divided. Nothing in the nature of millions, of course, but a considerable sum, oh, yes. Yes. And with that comfortable thought, gentlemen, I believe we must now turn our attention.
They turned it to the technical questions of impressment, tenders and guardships, matters outside Sir Joseph's province, and he leant back in his chair watching the speakers, assessing their abilities. Poor, on the whole. And the new First Lord was a fool, a mere politician.
Sir Joseph had served under Chatham, Spencer, St. Vincent, and Melville, and this man made a pitiful figure beside them. They'd had their failings, particularly Chatham, but not one would so have missed the point. The whole expense, in this case, would have been borne by the Spaniards. It would have been the Spaniards who provided the Royal Navy with the splendid example of four youngish post-captains caught in a great shower, a downpour of gold. The money would not have left the country. Naval fortunes were not so common, and the fortunes there were had nearly all been amassed by admirals in lucrative commands, taking their flag share for innumerable captures in which they personally took no part whatsoever. The captains who fought the ships, those were the men to encourage. Perhaps he hadn't made his point as clearly or as forcibly as he should have done. He was not in form after a sleepless night with seven reports from Boulogne to digest. But in any case, no other First Lord except perhaps St. Vincent would have made the question turn on party politics. And quite certainly not a single one of them would have blurted out the name of a secret agent. Both Lord Melville, a man who really understood intelligence, a splendid First Lord, and Sir Joseph, were much attached to Dr. Matchelin, their adviser on Spanish and especially Catalan affairs, a most uncommon, wholly disinterested agent, brave, painstaking, utterly reliable and ideally qualified, who had never accepted the slightest reward for his services. And such services! It was he who had brought them the intelligence that had allowed them to deliver this crippling blow. Sir Joseph and Lord Melville had devised the temporary commission as a means of obliging him to accept a fortune supplied by the enemy. And now his name had been brayed out in public, not even in the comparative privacy of the board, but in a far more miscellaneous gathering, with the question openly directed at the Chief of Naval Intelligence. It was unqualifiable. To rely on the discretion of these sailors, whose only notion of dealing with an enemy as cunning as Bonaparte was to blow him out of the water, was unqualifiable. To say nothing of the civilians, the talkative politicians, whose nearest approach to danger was a telescope on Dover Cliffs, where they could look at Bonaparte's invasion army, 200,000 strong, camped on the other side of the water. He looked at the faces round the long table. They were growing heated about the relative jurisdictions of the impress service proper and the gangs from the ships. Admiral called to admiral in voices that could be heard in Whitehall, and the First Lord seemed to have no control of the meeting whatsoever. Sir Joseph took comfort from this. The gaff might be forgotten. But still, he said to himself, drawing the metamorphoses of a red admiral, egg, caterpillar, chrysalis, and imago on his pad, what shall I say to him when we meet? What kind of face can I put on it when I see him? In Whitehall, a grey drizzle wept down upon the Admiralty,
But in Sussex the air was dry, dry and perfectly still. The smoke rose from the chimney of the small drawing-room at Mapes Court in a tall, unwavering plume, 100 feet before its head drifted away in a blue mist to lie in the hollows of the downs behind the house. The leaves were hanging yet, but only just. And from time to time the bright yellow rounds on the tree outside the window dropped of themselves, twirling in their slow fall to join the golden carpet at its foot, and in the silence the whispering impact of each leaf could be heard. A silence as peaceful as an easy death. At the first breath of a wind those trees will all be bare, observed Dr. Maturin. Yet autumn is a kind of spring, too, for there is never a one but is pushed off by its own next coming bud. You see that so clearly farther south, in Catalonia now, where you and Jack are to come as soon as the war is over. The autumn rains bring up the grass like an army of spears, and even here, my dear, a trifle less butter, if you please. I am already in a high state of grief. Stephen Maturin had dined with the ladies of Mapes, Mrs. Williams, Sophia, Cecilia, and Francis. Traces of brown Windsor soup, codfish, pigeon pie, and baked custard could be seen on his neckcloth, his snuff-coloured waistcoat, and his drab breeches, for he was an untidy eater, and he'd lost his napkin before the first remove, in spite of Sophia's efforts at preserving it. And now he was sitting on one side of the fire drinking tea, while Sophia toasted him crumpets on the other, leaning forward over the pink and silver glow with particular attention, neither to scorch the crumpet by holding it too close, nor to parch it by holding it too far down. In the fading light, the glow caught her rounded forearm and her lovely face, exaggerating the breadth of her forehead and the perfect cut of her lips, emphasizing the extraordinary bloom of her complexion. Her anxiety for the crumpet did away with the usual reserve of her expression. She had her younger sister's trick of showing the tip of her tongue when she was concentrating, and this, with so high a degree of beauty, gave her an absurdly touching appearance. He looked at her with great complacency, feeling an odd constriction at his heart, a feeling without a name. She was engaged to be married to his particular friend, Captain Aubrey of the Navy. She was his patient. And they were as close as a man and woman can be where there is no notion of gallantry between them. Closer, perhaps, than if they'd been lovers. He said, "This is an elegant crumpet, Sophie, to be sure, but it must be the last, and I do not recommend another for you, my dear, either. You are getting too fat. You were quite haggard and pitiful not 6 months ago, but the prospect of marriage suits you, I find. You must have put on half a stone, and your complexion. Sophie, why do you thread transpierce another crumpet? Who is that crumpet for? For whom is that crumpet, say? It is for me, my dear. Jack said I was to be firm. Jack loves firmness of character. He said that Lord Nelson, far, far over the still and almost freezing air, came the sound of a horn on Polkerry Down. They both turned to the window. "Did they kill their fox, I wonder now?" said Stephen. "If Jack were home, he would know the animal." "Oh, I'm so glad he's not out there on that wicked great bay," said Sophia. "He'd always managed to get him off, and I was always afraid he'd break his leg like young Mr. Savile. Stephen, will you help me draw the curtain?" "How she has grown up," said Stephen privately. And aloud, as he looked out of the window, holding the cord in one hand, "What is the name of that tree? The slim exotic standing on the lawn?" "We call it the pagoda tree," It's not a real pagoda tree, but that's what we call it. My Uncle Palmer, the traveller, planted it, and he said it was very like. As soon as she'd spoken, Sophia regretted it. She regretted it even before the sentence was out, for she knew where the word might lead Stephen's mind. These uneasy intuitions are so often right. To anyone who had the least connection with India, the pagoda tree must necessarily be associated with those parts. Pagodas were small gold coins resembling its leaves. And shaking the pagoda tree meant making an Indian fortune, becoming a nabob. A usual expression. Both Sophia and Stephen were concerned with India, because Diana Villiers was said to be there with her lover and, indeed, keeper, Richard Canning. Diana was Sophia's cousin, once her rival for the affections of Jack Aubrey, and at the same time the object of Stephen's eager, desperate pursuit. A dashing young woman of surprising charms and undaunted firmness of character, who had been very much part of their lives until her elopement with Mr. Canning. She was the black sheep of the family, of course, the scabbed ewe, and in principle her name was never mentioned at Mapes. Yet it was surprising how much they knew about her movements and how great a place she occupied in their thoughts. The newspapers had told them a great deal, for Mr. Canning was something of a public figure, a wealthy man with interests in shipping and in the East India Company. In politics, he and his relations own 3 rotten boroughs, appointing members to sit for them, since they could not sit themselves, being Jews. And in the social world, Mr. Canning, having friends among the Prince of Wales, is set. And rumour, making its way from the next county, where his cousins, the goldsmiths, lived, had told them more. But even so, they had nothing like the information that Stephen Maturin possessed. For in spite of his unworldly appearance and his unfeigned devotion to natural philosophy, he had wide-reaching contacts and great skill in using them. He knew the name of the East Indiaman in which Mrs. Villiers had sailed, the position of her cabin, the names of her 2 maids, their relations and background. One was French, with a soldier brother taken early in the war and now imprisoned at Norman Cross. He knew the number of bills she had left unpaid and their amount. He knew a great deal about the storm that had raged so violently in the Canning, Goldsmith and McCarter families, and that was still raging, for Mrs. Canning, a goldsmith by birth, had no notion of a plurality of wives, and she called upon all her relations to defend her with a furious, untiring zeal. A storm that had induced Canning to leave for India with an official mission connected with the French establishments on the Malabar coast. A rare place for gathering pagodas. Sophia was right. These were, indeed, the thoughts that flooded into Stephen's mind at the name of that unlucky tree. These and a great many more, as he sat silently by the glow of the fire. Not that they had far to travel. They hovered most of the time at no great distance, ready to appear in the morning when he woke, wondering why he was so oppressed with grief. And when they were not immediately present, their place was marked by a physical pain in his midriff, in an area that he could cover with the palm of his hand. In a secret drawer of his desk, making it difficult to open or close, lay docketed reports headed Villiers Diana, widow of Charles Villiers, late of Bombay, Esquire, and Canning Richard, of Park Street, and Coluba House care of Bristol. These 2 were as carefully documented as any pair of state suspects working for Bonaparte's intelligence services. And although much of this mass of paper had come from benevolent sources, A good deal of it had been acquired in the ordinary way of business, and it had cost a mint of money. Stephen had spared no expense in making himself more unhappy. His own position as a rejected lover even clearer. "Why do I gather all these wounds?" he wondered. "With what motive?" "To be sure, in war any accession of intelligence is an advance, and I may call this a private war. Is it to persuade myself that I am fighting still, although I have been beaten out of the field?" "Rational enough, but no doubt false. Too glib it is." He uttered these remarks in Catalan, for being something of a polyglot, he had a way of suiting his train of thought to the language that matched it best. His mother was a Catalan, his father an Irish officer. And Catalan, English, French, Castilian came to him as naturally as breathing, without preference except for subject. "How I wish I'd held my tongue," thought Sophie. She looked anxiously at Stephen as he sat there bent and staring into the red cavern under the log. "Poor dear thing," she thought. "How very much he is in need of darning. How very much he needs someone to look after him. He really isn't fit to wander about the world alone. It's so hard to unworldly people. How could she have been so cruel? It was like hitting a child. A child. How little learning does for a man. He knows almost nothing. He had but to say, 'Pray be so good as to marry me last summer,' and she would have cried, 'Oh, yes, if you please. I told him so.' Not that she would ever have made him happy." Bitch was the word that struggled to make itself heard, but it struggled in vain. "I shall never love that pagoda tree again. We were so pleasant together, and now it's as though the fire had gone out. It will go out, too, unless I put another log on, and it's quite dark." Her hand went out towards the bell pull to ring for candles, wavered and returned to her lap. "It's terrible how people suffer," she thought. "How lucky I am. Sometimes it terrifies me. Dearest Jack." Her inner eye filled with a brilliant image of Jack Aubrey. Tall, straight, cheerful, overflowing with life and direct, open affection, his yellow hair falling over his post-captain's epaulette, and his high-coloured, weather-beaten face stretched in an intensely amused laugh. She could see the wicked scar that ran from the angle of his jaw right up into his scalp, every detail of his uniform, his Nile medal, and the heavy curved sword the Patriotic Fund had given him for sinking the Bellone. His bright blue eyes almost vanished when he laughed. All you saw were shining slits, even bluer in the scarlet flush of mirth. Never was there anyone with whom she'd had such fun. No one had ever laughed like that. The vision was shattered by the opening of the door, and a flood of light from the hall. The squat, thick form of Mrs. Williams stood there, black in the doorway, and her loud voice cried, "What? What is this? Sitting alone in the dark?" Her eyes darted from the one to the other to confirm the suspicions that had been growing in her mind ever since the silence had fallen between them, a silence of which she was perfectly aware, as she had been sitting in the library close to a cupboard in the panelling. When this cupboard door was open, one couldn't help hearing what was said in the small drawing-room. But their immobility their Sybil, surprised faces turned towards her, convinced Mrs. Williams of her mistake, and she said with a laugh, "A lady and gentleman sitting alone in the dark, it would never have done in my time, la! The gentleman of the family would have called upon Dr. Maturin for an explanation. Where's Cecilia? She ought to have been keeping you company. In the dark. But I dare say you were thinking of the candles, Sophie. Good girl, you wouldn't credit, Doctor," she said, turning towards her guest with a polite look. For although Dr. Maturin was scarcely to be compared with his friend Captain Aubrey, he was known to be the possessor of a marble bath and of a castle in Spain. A castle in Spain! And he might very well do for her younger daughter. Had Cecilia been sitting in the dark with Dr. Maturin, she would never have burst in. You wouldn't credit her candles have risen. No doubt Cecilia would have had the same idea. All my daughters have been brought up with a strict sense of economy, Dr. Maturin. There is no waste in this house. However, if it had been Cecilia in the dark with a bow, that would never have done. The game wouldn't have been worth the candle. No, sir, you would never believe how wax has gone up since the beginning of the war. Sometimes I'm tempted to turn to tallow, but poor though we are, I cannot bring myself to it. At least, not in the public rooms. However, I have two candles burning in the library, and you shall have one. John need not light the sconces in here. I was obliged to have two, Dr. Maturin, for I've been sitting with my man of business all this time. Nearly all this time. The writings and the contracts and the settlements are so very long and complicated, and I'm an infant in these matters. The infant's estate ran far beyond the parish boundaries, and tenants' babies as far away as Starvacre, on being told Mrs. Williams will come for you, would fall mute with horror. But Mr. Wilbraham throws out some pretty severe reflections on us all for our dilatoriness, as he calls it, though I'm sure it's not our fault with Captain A so far away. She bustled away for the candle, pursing her mouth. These negotiations were drawing out in length, not from any petulance on the part of Mr. Wilbraham, but because of Mrs. Williams' iron determination not to part with her daughter's virginity or her £10,000 until an adequate provision, a binding marriage settlement, had been signed, sealed, and above all, the hard cash delivered. It was this that was hanging fire so strangely. Jack had agreed to all the conditions, however rapacious. He'd tied up his property, pay, prospects, and future prize money for the benefit of his widow and any offspring of this union for ever in the most liberal way, as though he had been a pauper. But still the actual money did not appear, and not a step would Mrs. Williams move until it was in her hands, not in promises, but in minted gold, or its copper-bottomed Bank of England guaranteed equivalent. "There," she said, coming back and looking sharply at the log which Sophia had put on the fire. "One will be enough, will it not, unless you wish to read? But I dare say you still have plenty to talk about." "Yes," said Sophia when they were alone again. "There is something I should like to ask you. I've been meaning to draw you aside ever since you came. It's dreadful to be so ignorant, and I would not have Captain Aubrey know it for the world. And I cannot ask my mother, but with you it's quite different."
"One may say anything at all to a medical man," said Stephen, and a look of professional, anonymous gravity came over his face, partly overlaying its look of strong personal affection.
"A medical man?" cried Sophia. "Oh, yes, of course, certainly. But what I really meant, dear Stephen, was this war. It's been going on forever now, apart from that short break. Going on forever. Oh, how I wish it would stop. For years and years, as long as I can remember. But I'm afraid I've not always paid as much attention as I should. Of course, I do know it's the French who are so wicked, but there are all these people who keep coming and going. The Austrians, the Spaniards, the Russians. Pray, are the Russians a good thing now? It would be very shocking, treason, no doubt, to put the wrong people in my prayers. And there are all those Italians and the poor dear Pope. And only the very day before he left, Jack mentioned Papenburg. He'd hoisted the flag of Papenburg by way of a ruse de guerre. So Papenburg must be a country. I was despicably false and only nodded, looking as wise as I could, and said, "Ah, Papenburg, I'm so afraid he'll think me ignorant. Which, of course, I am, but I cannot bear him to know it. I'm sure there are quantities of young women who know where Papenburg is, and Batavia, and this Ligurian Republic. But we never did such places with Miss Blake, and this Kingdom of the Two Sicilies. I can find one on the map, but not the other. Stephen, pray tell me the present state of the world."
"Is it the state of the world, my dear?" said Stephen with a grin. No professional look left at all. "Well, now, for the moment, it's plain enough. On our side, we have Austria, Russia, Sweden, and Naples, which is the same as your two Sicilies. And on his, he has a whole cloud of little states, and Bavaria, and Holland, and Spain. Not that these alliances are of much consequence one side or the other. The Russians were with us, and then against us until they strangled their Tsar, and now with us. And I dare say they'll change again when the whim bites. The Austrians left the war in 97, and then again in the year 1 after Hohenlinden. The same thing may happen again any day. What matters to us is Holland and Spain. For they have navies, and if ever this war is to be won, it must be won at sea. Bonaparte has about 45 ships of the line, and we have 80-odd, which sounds well enough, but ours are scattered all over the world, and his are not. Then again, the Spaniards have 27, to say nothing of the Dutch, so it is essential to prevent them from combining. For if Bonaparte can assemble a superior force in the Channel, even for a little while, then his invasion army can come across, God forbid. That is why Jack and Lord Nelson are beating up and down off Toulon, bottling up Monsieur de Villeneuve with his 11 ships of the line and 7 frigates, preventing them from combining with the Spaniards in Cartagena and Cadiz and Ferrol. And that is where I am going to join him as soon as I've been to London to settle one or two little points of business and to buy a large quantity of madder. So if you have any messages, now is the time, for Sophie, I am upon the wing." He stood up, scattering crumbs, and the clock on the black cabinet struck the hour. "Oh, Stephen, must you go?" cried Sophie. "Let me brush you a little. Will you not stay supper? Pray do stay supper. I'll make you toasted cheese."
"I will not, my dear, though you are very kind," said Stephen, standing like a horse as she brushed at him, turned down his collar and twitched at his cravat. Since his disappointment he'd grown less nice about his linen. He'd given up the practice of brushing his clothes or his boots, and neither his face nor his hands were particularly clean. "There is a meeting of the Entomological Society that I might just be able to attend if I hurry. There, there, my dear, that'll do. Mary and Joseph, I'm not going to court. The entomologists do not set up for bows. Now, give me a kiss like a good creature and tell me what I'm to say. What messages I am to give to Jack?" "How I wish, oh, how I wish I were going with you. It would be of no use begging him to be prudent, not to take risks, I suppose. I'll mention it if you choose. But believe me, Honey Jack is not an imprudent man, not at sea. He never takes a risk without he's weighed it very carefully. He loves his ship and his men too much, far too much, to run them into any unconsidered danger. He's not one of your wild, hit-or-miss, fire-eating rapparees.
He wouldn't do anything rash.
Never in life. It's true, you know. Quite true, he added, seeing that Sophia was not wholly persuaded that Jack at sea and Jack ashore were two different persons. Well, she said, and paused.
How long it seems. Everything seems to take so very long.
Nonsense, said Stephen with an assumed liveliness. Parliament rises in a few weeks' time. Captain Hammond will go back to his ship, and Jack will be thrown on the beach again. You will see as much of him as your heart could desire. Now, what shall I say?
Give him my dearest love, Stephen, if you please. And pray, pray, take the greatest care of yourself, too.
Dr. Maturin walked into the Entomological Society's meeting as the Reverend Mr. Lamb began his paper on certain nondescript beetles found on the shore at Pringle Juxtamere in the year 1799. He sat down at the back and listened closely for a while, but presently the gentleman strayed from his theme, as everyone had known he would, and began to harangue the gathering on the hibernation of swallows, for he'd found a new prop for his theory. Not only did they fly in ever-decreasing circles, conglobulate in a mass and plunge to the bottoms of quiet ponds, but they also took refuge in the shafts of tin mines. Of Cornish tin mines, gentlemen. Stephen's attention wandered, and he glanced over the restless entomologists. Several he knew. The worthy Dr. Musgrave, who had favoured him with a prime carina quindecim punctata, Mr. Tolston of stag beetle fame, Eusebius Piscator, that learned Swede, and surely the plump-back and powdered queue looked familiar. It was odd how one's eye must take in and store innumerable measurements and proportions. A back was almost as recognisable as a face. This applied also to gait, stance, lift of head. What countless references at every turn! This back was turned from his with an odd, unnatural twist, and its owner's left hand was raised, resting on his jaw, in such a way as to shield his face. No doubt it was this twist that had caught his eye. Yet in all their dealings he'd never seen Sir Joseph writhe himself into such an attitude.
"And so, gentlemen, I believe I may confidently state that the hibernation of swallows, and of all the other hirundines, is conclusively proved," said Mr. Lamb, with a defiant glare at his audience.
"I am sure we're all very grateful to Mr. Lamb," said the chairman, in an atmosphere of general discontent and with some cross shuffling of feet and murmuring. "And although I'm afraid that we are now short of time, perhaps not all the papers can be read, allow me to call on Sir Joseph Blaine to favour us with his remarks on a true gynandromorph recently added to his cabinet." Sir Joseph half rose in his place, and begged to be excused. He'd left his notes behind. He was not perfectly well, and would not try the patience of the meeting by trying to speak without him. He begged pardon, but thought he would retire.
It was only a passing indisposition, he said, to reassure the company. The company would not have cared if it had been the great spotted leprosy. Three entomologists were already on their feet, eager for immortality in the society's proceedings.
What am I to infer from this?
Asked Stephen of himself, as Sir Joseph passed with a distant bow. And during the following account of luminous beetles, lately received from Suriname, a fascinating account which she should certainly read with great attention later, the cold presentiment formed in his bosom. He carried this presentiment with him from the meeting. But he had not walked 100 yards before a discreet messenger accosted him and gave him a card with a cipher and an invitation not to Sir Joseph's official apartments, but to a little house behind Shepherd Market.
"How good of you to come," said Sir Joseph,
seating Stephen by the fire in what was clearly his library, study and drawing-room. It was comfortable, even luxurious, in the style of 50 years before. And cases of butterflies alternated with pornographic pictures on the walls. Emphatically, a private house.
"How truly kind."
He was nervous and ill at ease, and he said, "How truly kind," again. Stephen said nothing.
"I beg you to come here," Sir Joseph went on, "because this is my private, shall I say, refuge, and I feel I owe you a private explanation. When I saw you this evening, I was not expecting you. My conscience gave me a rude jerk. It put me about strangely, because I have exceedingly disagreeable news for you. News that I should rather have any other man deliver, but that necessarily falls to me. I had prepared myself for it at our meeting tomorrow morning, and I should have done it well enough, I dare say, but seeing you suddenly there, in that atmosphere... To put it in a word," he said, putting down the poker with which he'd been teasing the fire, "there has been a grave indiscretion at the Admiralty. Your name was mentioned and insisted upon at a general meeting in direct connection with the action off Cadiz."
Stephen bowed, but still said nothing. Sir Joseph, looking at him covertly, went on.
"Of course, I drowned the indiscretion at once, and afterwards I let it be understood that you were aboard by chance, that you were bound for some undefined eastern region, in a scientific or quasi-diplomatic capacity, in which a commission would be necessary for your status, for your eventual negotiations, citing the precedent of Banks and Halley, that its connection with this incident was purely fortuitous and coincidental, occasioned only by the need for extreme haste. This I have put about as the true inside story, far more secret than the interception, known only to the initiated, and not to be divulged on any account. It should answer with most of the sailors and civilians who were present. The fact remains that, in spite of my efforts, you are somewhat blown upon. And this necessarily calls our whole program into question."
"Who were the gentlemen present?" asked Stephen. Sir Joseph passed him a list. "A considerable gathering. There is a strange levity," he said coldly, "a strange, weak irresponsibility in playing with men's lives and a whole system of intelligence in this manner."
"I entirely agree," cried Sir Joseph. "It is monstrous. And I say so with the more pain, since it is I who am partly at fault. I admitted the First Lord on the subject, and I wholly relied upon his discretion. But no doubt I had allowed myself to become too much accustomed to a chief upon whom I could rely without question.
There never was a closer man than Lord Melville. A parliamentary government is hopeless for intelligence. New men come in, politicians rather than professionals, and we are all to seek. Your dictatorship is the only thing for intelligence. Bonaparte is far, far better served than His Majesty. But I must not evade the second unhappy issue. Although it will be a matter of public notoriety in a few days' time, I feel I must tell you myself that the board means to treat the Spanish treasure as droits of the crown. That is to say, it will not be distributed as prize money. I did everything in my power to avert this decision, but I'm afraid it is irrevocable. I tell you this in the faint hope that it might prevent you from committing yourself to any course of action on the contrary assumption. Even a few days' warning is perhaps better than none at all. I also tell you with the utmost regret, because I'm aware that you have another interest in this matter. I can only hope, alas, without much conviction, that my warning may have some slight... You follow me. And as for my personal expressions of extreme regret, intense chagrin and concern, upon my word, I scarcely know how to phrase them with a tenth of the force they require.
You are very good, said Stephen, and I am most sensible of this mark of confidence. I will not pretend that the loss of a fortune can be a matter of indifference to any man. I do not feel any emotion other than petty vexation at the moment, though no doubt I shall in time. But the interest to which you so obligingly refer is another matter. Allow me to make it clear. I particularly wished to serve my friend Aubrey. His agent absconded with all his prize money. The Court of Appeal reversed the condemnation of 2 neutral vessels, leaving him £11,000 in debt. This happened when he was on the point of becoming engaged to a most amiable young woman. They are deeply attached to one another. But since her mother, a widow with considerable property under her own control, is a deeply stupid, griping, illiberal, avid, tenacious, pinch-fist lickpenny, a sordid lickpenny and a shrew, there is no hope of marriage without his estate is cleared and he can make at least some kind of settlement upon her. That was the position I flattered myself I had dealt with, or rather that you, a kind fate, and the conjuncture had dealt with for me. That was the understanding of all concerned. What am I now to tell Aubrey when I join him at Menorca? Does anything accrue to him from this action at all? Oh, yes, certainly. There will certainly be an ex gratia payment. Indeed, it might clear the debts you mention, or very nearly. But it will not be wealth. Oh, dear me, no, far from it. But, my dear sir, you speak of Menorca. Do I collect that you mean to continue with our original plan in spite of this wretched, unnecessary contretemps?
I believe so, said Stephen, studying the list again. There is so much to be gained from our recent contact, so much to be lost by not. In this case, it seems to be essentially a question of time. As far as common loose talk and confidential rumour are concerned, I must, in all probability, outrun it, since I sail tomorrow night. Information of this seeping kind is unlikely to move as fast as a determined traveller, and in any event you've dealt with the more obvious prattlers. This is the only name here I'm afraid of. Pointing to the list, he is, as you know, a pederast. Not that I have anything against pederasty myself. Each man must decide for himself where beauty lies, and surely the more affection in this world the better. But it is common knowledge that some pederasts are subject to pressures that do not apply to other men. If this gentleman's meetings with Monsieur de la Tapeterie could be discreetly watched, and above all, if la Tapeterie could be neutralized for a week, I should have no hesitation in carrying on with our former arrangement. Even without these precautions, I doubt I should put it off. These are the merest conjectures, after all, and it's no use sending Osborne or Schikaneder. Gomez would put his head into no man's hands but mine. And without that contact, the new system falls to pieces. That's true. And of course you understand the